good evening. A shooting at an airbase in Florida. Was it a terror attack? Trump's Saudi connections and Mayor de Blasio debuts a new crime-fighting strategy. But is it more of the same? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Friday, December 6, 2019. Officials say the suspect in a shooting that killed three people and injured eight others at a naval base in Pensacola, Florida on Friday morning was a member of the Saudi Air Force who was in the United States for training. Several law enforcement sources identified the gunman who was killed in the incident as Mohammed Saeed Al-Shamrani. In a news conference that raised more questions than it answered, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made a cryptic statement to reporters saying Saudi Arabia will have a debt to pay because of the shooting.
There's obviously going to be a lot of questions about, you know, this individual being a foreign national, being a part of the Saudi Air Force, and then to be here training on our soil to do this. And the FBI is working with DOD, they're working with FDLE, they're working with the Escambia County Sheriffs to answer those questions. One of the things that I talked to the president about is, given that this was a foreign national in the employ of a foreign service, is and there'll be time to do this, but obviously the government of Saudi Arabia needs to make things better for these victims. And I think that they are going to owe a debt here, given that this is one of their individuals. But what I can tell you is...
Two Escambia County Sheriff's deputies who were at the scene immediately after reports of shots fired at about 6:50 a.m. were injured in the exchange of gunfire with the shooter, who authorities say was armed with a handgun. I could not be prouder of the men and women of the sheriff's office, Sheriff David Morgan said. They ran to the fight, not from the fight. But Morgan also made yet another eyebrow-raising comment about trusting his department to tell the truth.
So we're in a recovery mode right now. This is going to be a lengthy investigation. Do not expect quick answers. There's going to be some parts of this investigation, not only that we're a part of with the FBI and the ATF and the state authorities, that you may never have access to, just because of the fact of again, the nature of the case and who we're dealing with. That will be extremely frustrating for you. This is something I talk about in your government and your elected officials today that no one speaks of, and that's called trust. You're going to have to trust us. We're going to tell you what you need to know to keep our communities and our state and our nation safe. And I want to also assure you that from the men and women of the Escambia County Sheriff's Office, who are more than proud to serve every day, that you will hear the truth from us as best we can tell you. Pray for the Navy personnel.
DeSantis returned to the mic to make a clarification of his previous remarks, further deepening the mystery.
When you have a foreign national involved, you know, particularly in that part of the world, the investigation is obviously going to be different than if it were just somebody from a local community.
When you have a foreign national
and I think
involved,
you'll see that as things
you know, go
particularly
on.
In that part of the world.
DeSantis returned. Now the media was focused on the fact that the shooter was a student, a Saudi national, and a member of the kingdom's air force. That's when Naval Air Station Commander Captain Timothy Kinsella stepped forward to describe the level of secrecy involved.
We have an international training syllabus. We have students from several different countries that come here. They learn aviation. They become naval aviators while they're here. It's something that we've been doing for quite a while, and it's with our partner nations. It's important. That cross-pollination, that cross-training that we do with our allies is something that we've done for a long time. I mean, in World War II, we had Royal Air Force folks that were training here. There's always been international students training here because it's a good place to train, and it's a good quality training.
How many students do you have, international students?
I can't speak to the exact number of international students.
Roughly?
A couple of hundred.
What was he training to do, sir?
Second?
What was he training to do?
He was just in the aviation pipeline, so we'll just say he was training in aviation.
And at the time of the shooting, the suspect was a member of the Saudi Arabian Air Force?
I don't want to get into that. That's up to the FBI to complete their investigation to see exactly. It would be speculation on my part to say.
How far was he in the pipeline?
Again, I'm not going to speak to where he was in the pipeline or his exact training right now. I'll leave that.
Was he authorized to have a gun on base?
Weapons are not authorized on base. You can't bring a weapon on base. Unless you're
can you talk a bit about the security measures? I think that is one of the biggest questions. What types of measures are in place to keep something like this from happening?
Yeah, that's something that's difficult for me to speak here because our security measures, well, they're we keep them to ourselves for a reason. If I talk to you about our security measures, but I will say that we practice to this. This is part of our training. Our Master at Arms and our civilian DOD, along with Escambia County and Sheriff's Department and with Pensacola Police Department, we train to active shooter scenarios regularly. We just did one recently. So this is, we never expect it, but we train for it, and we remain ever vigilant for it.
Do you expect there's going to be more changes to
security? Again, I'm not going to speculate.
Sure. How are you confident that he was acting alone?
I'm not going to speculate on the particulars of the investigation or exactly what happened.
Captain, can you talk about the...
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you, everybody.
Captain Kinsella said foreign students from ally and partner nations have been coming to train at the base since at least World War II. He said there have always been international students training here because it's a good place to train. It's good quality training. At a news conference, President Trump acknowledged the shooting and transmitted condolences from Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. King Salman of Saudi Arabia just called to express his sincere condolences and give his sympathies to the families and friends of the warriors who were killed and wounded in the attack that took place just recently, just this morning, in Pensacola, Florida. The king said that the Saudi people are greatly angered by the barbaric actions of the shooter and that this person in no way, shape, or form represents the feelings of the Saudi people who love the American people so much. So that was just given to me by the king of Saudi Arabia. And I can tell you it's a horrible thing that took place. And we're getting to the bottom of it. All of the investigators are there now, and they're studying it very closely. And terrible thing. And our condolences go to the families and to everybody involved, including the wounded. We have some badly wounded people also. And we have to extend our condolences to them, and we'll be working with them all very closely. So I just wanted to let you know that was from King Salman.
The Trump administration has been closely linked to the Saudi crown prince from the start. The president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is a close associate of MBS. In a transactional series of events, Kushner attempted to help to get help from MBS in pressuring the Palestinians to return in return for shepherding a deal to take the Saudi-owned oil company Aramco public. The offering never happened. Reportedly, Kushner dismissed the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi by agents of the Saudi government because Khashoggi, a Washington Post columnist, was allegedly a terrorist, in Kushner's opinion. And it's the second shooting at a U.S. Navy base this week. The U.S. Navy sailor who fatally shot two people at Pearl Harbor before killing himself was unhappy with his commanders and had been undergoing counseling. That was according to a military official on Friday. Gabriel Romero, 22, also faced non-judicial punishment, which is a lower-level administrative process for minor misconduct, said the official who spoke on condition of anonymity. He used his two service weapons in the attack, according to the official. Romero also wounded a 36-year-old man in the attack Wednesday at the Naval Shipyard within the storied military base before turning the gun on himself. The victim is in stable condition at a hospital. In a second attack at a Navy base this week, as we just reported, the shooter opened fire in a classroom building Friday at the Naval Air Station Pensacola in Florida, leaving four people dead, including the assailant, and multiple people wounded. The Pearl Harbor shooting came just days before a ceremony to remember those who perished in the Japanese bombing 78 years ago that propelled the U.S. into World War II, and that will be tomorrow. And we'll be doing a special report on the WBAI News, marking the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack and the beginning of U.S. involvement in World War II. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored, locally produced WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In local news, the nation's largest police department has selected a black man to lead its detective squad. The NYPD promoted two minority officers, to new leadership positions inside the department on Wednesday, according to a spokesperson, after the somewhat controversial decision regarding who will lead the department. Rodney Harrison was named the new chief of detectives, according according to the spokesperson, Harrison 50 previously served as the chief of patrol and becomes the first African-American to serve in the role. Filling his position as chief of patrol will be Fausto Pichardo, a 20-year veteran of the department. The Dominican-American Pichardo previously worked under Harrison as executive officer in the patrol bureau. The promotions come days after Dermot Shea, the former chief of detectives, was moved to his job as commissioner. He says he plans to inject more life into the city's community policing programs, making for better relations between cops and the community. But Shea also took issue with sweeping reforms that go into effect on January 1st, almost entirely eliminating bail for most nonviolent offenders. At his first news conference since being sworn in Tuesday, Commissioner Shea raised alarms about the sweeping changes that will go into effect on January 1st. "Do I have concerns about parts of it? Yes, I do," Shea said. During an appearance in the Bronx, he said he opposed provisions that will bar judges from setting bail for defendants. Speaking today on another radio station, Mayor Bill de Blasio said he has to balance rights against legitimate concerns over quality of life offenses.
Quality of life policing is what we talk about. Broken windows has become, understandably, a term that evokes so many different things in so many different people, and its origins have real problems associated with them. So we don't talk about that. We talk about a very different and clear approach. The combination of neighborhood policing, which is developing deep relationships between police and community and mutual respect, precision policing, which is specifically focusing on the very, very few people who create most of the crime and violence. And then quality of life policing means listening to communities. And I was a city council member. I worked very closely block by block with communities. Brian, in the larger debate, I think what's often missed, and I say this with real respect for advocates who are, you know, people who I think are heartfelt and are trying to do good, but I think they often miss the reality of life in our neighborhoods. Constantly, I hear from my constituents, they are concerned about quality of life issues. They really want to see these issues addressed. They don't want over policing. They don't want draconian policing, but they do want quality of life issues addressed. And under neighborhood policing, you'd be amazed. I talked to our neighborhood coordinating officers who are extraordinary people, listening to residents. For example, our officers who work in public housing listen to the residents and they respond. And if a resident's concerned about something they feel is negatively affecting their quality of life, our officers are supposed to be responsive and respectful of that. There used to be a reality in the city in many communities, particularly communities of color, where you couldn't get police follow-up decades ago on real issues that were affecting people. So the balance to strike, and this is an honest conversation we need to have as New Yorkers, mm-hmm. is we want the police to respond to concerns of everyday New Yorkers. We don't want overreach. We don't want a aggressive, punitive approach. And we're trying to strike the balance. Remember, with stops so far down, arrests so far down, 150,000 fewer arrests last year than 5 years earlier, much less incarceration, obviously, thank God, we are finding that we can keep this city safe with a much lighter touch. But that does not mean ignoring when a constituent says, I have a problem and this is affecting my quality of life.
But activists say quality of life offenses are minor compared to the lack of action on violent crimes, especially when committed by police officers against people of color. Lumumba Bandele spoke on behalf of Community United for Police Reform.
Fundamentally does not change what our coalition's demands continue to be. Those are always around community-controlled policies, making sure that there's always accountability, that the most immediate thing really is the backlog of cases that need to be addressed by the NYPD in terms of people who are responsible for the murders and beatings of civilians, particularly people of color within New York City. So it doesn't change. We do know that our demands have never been for more gentler policing and has never been for a more diverse police force. It really has been about creating safer communities and making sure that we can minimize the kind of damage that the police force has historically been known for, that we're responsible for really creating the kind of safety that our communities need, and looking at some of the human service components that the state and the city particularly are responsible for making sure exist, and not trying to make those things the responsibility of police. The police should not be providing youth services for young people throughout the city. That's not their job. That's not their expertise. They should not be providing mental health are attempting to provide mental health services. That not it's not their expertise, not their job. Should not be doing the same around education. All of these things really are required to be done by professionals, by people who know how to do this work, and really try to minimize the interaction that our communities have with law enforcement.
He seemed to say, he laid out some statistics that there's a lot less arrests, things have gotten better. You said there was a backlog. That doesn't seem to imply it was getting better.
Well, we're talking about backlog of police officers who have yet to be investigated and or charged for the murders and beatings of our community members. So that is a very long list. The mayor has a very clear and embarrassingly horrible position and history around police accountability. His history of not allowing the investigations and, in fact, sometimes challenging, complicating the investigations of police officers is one that speaks for itself. And so we're really clear about what the city is going to be doing, has been doing. We have no kind of illusions that this new leadership will change anything. Again, we do consider this to be some, in some level, window dressing.
He also says that the public wants police protection, that they might not want it to be people to be killed and all these things, but they actually do want the police in their community.
And there's a segment of people who I think have been socialized to, and many of us, you know, and I don't want to other them, but many of us have been socialized to really believe that police equate safety, and we increasingly are learning that to be false. I, for example, live around a corner from a police precinct. Theoretically, this idea that police presence makes communities, makes people safe, is a falsehood, because if that were the case, I should live in one of the safest blocks in New York City. That's not the case. We know that there's so many other things that contribute to safety that are not attached to law enforcement, and we want to really make sure that those things are prioritized. We really want to make sure that people have employment, people have adequate housing, adequate health care, people have adequate holistic health care, which means mental health, which means physical health, people have housing, all of these things that are necessary to create a whole human being and thus create whole and healthy communities. Those are the priorities that we want to see happen, and those are the things that will reflect a safe community.
Lumumba Bendele on behalf of Community United for Police Reform. And in related news, as far as police violence across the country, relatives of a UPS driver killed after robbery suspects took him hostage on a wild police chase across South Florida questioned Friday why officers had to unleash a torrent of gunfire when the truck got stuck in rush hour traffic. Both suspects, 41-year-old cousins Lamar Alexander and Ronnie Jerome Hill, were killed along with the driver, Frank Ordonez, and another motorist, 70-year-old Richard Cutshaw, who was waiting at a busy intersection when the officers ran up and opened fire from behind the cars of innocent bystanders. The chase and final shootout were broadcast live on television, including the moments when one of the men tumbled out of the truck, mortally wounded. Ordonez's family said the father of two was filling in on someone else's route Thursday when the robbery suspects commandeered his truck. Luis Ordonez told Associated Press on Friday, "I saw on TV when he fell and I knew it was him. I saw how they killed my brother." He said the police were insane. Instead of talking to them, they just started shooting. I know they, the robbery suspects, were shooting back at them, but it was easy to just cover behind police cars. They could have just covered themselves. News helicopters showed first responders tending to the person who fell from the truck moments after the gunfire ended in Miramar, about 20 miles north of the jewelry store robbery. FBI agent in charge, George Pirro, was asked at a news conference Thursday night whether either the UPS driver or the other victim could have been killed by police bullets. He said it's very, very early on in the investigation and it would be completely inappropriate to discuss that. We've just begun the process, the crime scene. And on Wednesday, a boat carrying at least 150 people from the West African nation of Gambia capsized in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Mauritania. 83 people swam to shore, but 58 people are dead. It was one of the deadliest disasters this year among migrants trying to make the perilous journey to Europe. Milton Alamadi has the story.
More bodies could still be recovered. The dead include women and children. A rickety ship capsized. The victims were mostly from the Gambia, economic refugees seeking income. Youth from all parts of Africa make this dangerous voyage annually. Youth unemployment in Africa ranges from 60% in South Africa to 80% in Uganda. In 2016, as many as 5,000 people drowned crossing the Mediterranean, according to the International Organization for Migration. The death migration escalated after NATO's war on Libya destroyed the Muammar Gaddafi regime in 2011. Tens of thousands of workers from other parts of Africa had decent incomes in oil-rich Libya, money they sent to their families back in other African countries. In NATO's Libya, Africans are sold in slave markets. Many obviously prefer to take their chances in the high seas. This ugly passage cannot be blamed on the NATO war alone. Europe colonized Africa in the 19th century because it's the richest continent resource-wise. Its minerals and human resources allowed Europe to continue its industrial growth. Today, Africa still sells raw materials to Europe and imports manufactured products from Europe, from the United States, and from China. Africa subsidizes wealth of the rest of the world at a heavy cost to Africans. The African ruling elite have failed to transform their countries. In 1959, Ghana's income per head was greater than China's. Today, China's at close to $10,000 per head is more than six times that of Ghana's. Ghana is one of the better performing economies in Africa. China today competes with the West, the unified China, not the fragmented China of old. Youth of Africa are connected by social media to the rest of the world. They will seek their fortunes overseas as presidents of tiny African countries that are easy to exploit by industrialized ones fail to deliver. But things are changing. In the Sudan earlier this year, the youth and women led the charge in the streets. They deposed a dictator of 30 years. In Uganda, the youth are resisting a U.S.-backed tyrant of 34 years. What happened in the Sudan needs to be repeated throughout Africa. Compatriots in the U.S., in the progressive world, must help this effort. Only a United States of Africa will be strong enough to use Africa's resources to create wealth and prosperity in Africa for Africans. This was the vision of Marcus Garvey. This was the vision of Kwame Nkrumah. Until then, more drownings in the Mediterranean. Until then, Africa is not yet Uhuru. This is Milton Alimadi, host of Black Star News Show. And this is listener-supported commercial-free WBAI, New York.
Thank you, Milton. And finally, the drama on Capitol Hill continues. WBAI will be there with live coverage. Trump Watch host Jesse Lent.
Impeachment hearings in front of the House Judiciary Committee will resume Monday and will be carried live on this station, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, beginning at 9 a.m. and streaming on the web at WBAI.org. Monday's hearing will feature presentations from both Democratic and Republican lawyers for the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. The Intelligence Committee has overseen the investigation into the president's dealings with Ukraine, while the Judiciary Committee has reportedly been investigating the findings of the Mueller report into Russian interference in the 2016 election for the past several months. One person who will not speak at the hearing, despite an open invitation to appear from Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler, is President Trump. White House counsel Pat Cipollone informed the House they would not be participating in Monday's hearing less than an hour before the 5 p.m. Friday deadline imposed by Democratic leadership. In a letter to Chairman Nadler, Cipollone wrote, quote, House Democrats have wasted enough of America's time with this charade. For the WBAI Evening News, this has been Impeachment Watch. I'm Jesse Lent.
Thanks, Jesse. And WBAI's coverage will begin at 9 a.m. on Monday. And activists of all ages and from all corners of the planet demanded concrete action Friday against climate change from leaders and negotiators at a global summit in Madrid. The march was led by dozens of representatives of Latin America's indigenous peoples, a mark of deference after anti-government protests in Chile, the original host of the summit, resulted in the talks suddenly being moved to Europe for the third year in a row. Celebrity climate activist Greta Thunberg declared from a stage that change is not going to come from the people in power, it's going to come from the masses. A crowd of thousands responded, chanting, Greta, Greta. Organizers claimed 500,000 people turned out for the march, but authorities in Madrid put the number at 15,000 without an immediate explanation for the disparity in the count. The Swedish teen was followed on her first day in Madrid by a swarm of cameras and reporters, as well as curious members of the public wanting to film her on their smartphones. From the very first step she took out of an overnight train from Lisbon. Two young activists earned cheers as they abseiled from a bridge and strung out a banner saying, just 8 years till 1.5 degrees centigrade. How dare you? A reference to scientists' forecasts of rising temperatures and what activists complain is a lack of convincing political response to the threat. And that's some of the news for Friday, December 6, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jesse Lent. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios of listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent radio station WBAI, I'm Paul DiRienzo.